A good God in an evil world is a bit of a departure from the stuff I usually do, which is either critique evolutionary theories or try to develop a positive intelligent design program. And as I say in this book, in the introductory material, nothing really in the book hangs or falls on intelligent design or the evolution question. What got me into this problem, I guess there were two things. One is trying to provide some sort of justification for, or theological justification for, intelligent design. I remember about 8 years ago, I was on a PBS program with Peter Robinson, and my interlocutor was Bob Russell at CTNS, Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences. And in that conversation, Russell challenged me by saying, well, if this God is a designer, it's not the Christian God. And this has been a common criticism of intelligent design, that somehow it can't hold up theologically. If you have a designing God, well, then God is responsible for all the nasty things that we see in nature. I mean, you raised the question of parasitism, you know, and this is something I deal with in the book. And just even from non-Christians, it's been a real challenge to design what do you do with the problem of dysteleology, poor designs, malevolent designs, which seem to be all over the place. Now, the traditional view, I mean, traditionally Christianity hasn't had a problem with it, and that's because, I would say, that traditionally people, Christians, have been young earth creationists. And young earth creationists buys you something in this whole theodicy question, which is you don't have natural evil come on the scene until after humans sin and invite it into the world. Humanity becomes complicit in the evil, and then they open the Pandora's box, and then the evil comes upon the world. The problem, though, is if you don't accept young earth, and I don't, many in the intelligent design community don't, and certainly the theistic evolutionary community doesn't, we are going with contemporary astrophysics and geology, what do you do with natural evil that predates humans? And I can just give you a little indication of the sort of concerns that come up here. I mean, I cite them because it's why this young earth position is no longer seen to be tenable. And let me put it to you, though, that the young earth position was the position historically in the church. Sometimes Origen and Augustine are cited as not holding to young earth position, but they were. They were 6,000 or 5,500 year young earth creationists. The thing is, back then, that was 1,500, 2,000 years ago, they were going with the Septuagint, and that added about 1,500 years to the chronologies. But you go right through with the church fathers, you go to the scholastics. I finally tracked down where even Thomas Aquinas admits to a six-day literal, 24-hour 6,000-year chronology, or 7,000-year, depending on the translation or the version of the Old Testament that they're going to. So, and the Reformers also. I mean, Calvin and Luther were going with a young earth. Very, very literal. So why is that no longer tenable? And you can just read, I mean, I think some of the it's not just why isn't the young earth, but why isn't a traditional theodicy in which evil, both moral and natural evil, is ascribed to humanity's fall, why is that no longer regarded as tenable? And got it here. So just to give you a little sampling, I have lots of quotes, but John Polkinghorne, of course, physical death did not originate with our hominid ancestors, nor did the emergence of humankind bring about change in the physical constitution of the cosmos. Dennis Alexander, in the evangelical circles in which I was raised, it was common to believe that there was no pain, disease, or suffering of any kind before the fall, but that all these came into being following Adam and Eve's disobedience. As I grew in the Christian faith, the position I had unthinkingly adopted seemed increasingly untenable. I started studying biology and learning incontrovertible evidence that death has been present on the earth since the beginning of time. Jürgen Moltmann, if death came into the world only through sin, then we have to restrict this to the death of human beings. For the death of animals, the dying of trees, and the extinction of the dinosaurs can hardly be traced back to human sin. That would be a negative self-deification of human beings by way of an immense and presumptuous arrogation of guilt. Not every death in the world can be traced back to human sin. Okay, so this is, I would say, within mainstream academic theology, this is the overwhelming impression that a traditional view of the fall is no longer tenable. The idea that natural evil, physical evil, is the result of humanity's fall. And this, I would put it to you, this goes against traditional understanding of physical evil. Quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia, Christian philosophy has, like the Hebrew, uniformly attributed moral and physical evil. So moral evil is the evil that we do, the wickedness in our hearts and how it's expressed toward each other, toward the world. And then physical evil, parasites, earthquakes, death, disease, animal suffering, all of this. The physical evil has attributed, so Christian philosophy, like the Hebrew, uniformly attributed moral and physical evil to the action of created free will. Man has himself brought about the evil from which he suffers by transgressing the law of God on obedience to which his happiness depended. The errors of mankind mistaking the true conditions of its own being have been the cause of moral and physical evil. Okay, so that's the traditional view, and my problem, as it were, in this book is how to recover that view within an old earth framework in which physical death precedes. Physical death, pain, suffering, all that natural evil precedes, predates humans coming on the scene and then the fall for which they are responsible. So that's the problem. And what I found is, as I started thinking about this, I ended up reinventing an approach to this problem which had a small window among American geologists and theologians right around the 1840s and 50s, in which they saw the effects of the fall working not just forward in time, as the young earth creationists hold, and as these people who think that the attributing the natural evil to the fall is no longer tenable seem to hold, but also that it can go backwards in time. Now, there's theological precedent for a view like that. How were the Old Testament saints saved? Well, it was in virtue of the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, right? So the sacrifice of Christ, 33 AD, saves Old Testament saints that were living hundreds, thousands of years before that. So is it possible for the fall to have retroactive effects as well as proactive effects? Proactive being forward in time. And so that's the argument I want to make. It was an argument that was made by a group of what I would call biblical geologists in the 1840s and 50s. And I, in a sense, reinvented that, but I think I took it further than they did. That view really didn't take hold. I mean, I think Darwin comes along 1859, and even Princeton theologian Charles Hodge, who could I think have pushed that view, never seemed to really push it. So, as I said, I reinvented it, and what got me thinking about this, though, are various things about approaches to divine action and a certain paradox in physics, which got me thinking of what would be involved in divine God anticipating our fall by introducing natural evil. Okay, and how might that work? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, the fall has retroactive effects. There's a backward causation. Well, that sounds interesting from a science fiction perspective. But how does one make sense of that? And then also, is there some way to make exegetical sense of it? And so let me just talk about a few ideas or things that led me to this view, and then how this view actually does seem to mesh quite nicely with a certain approach to Genesis. Okay, because I do want to retain some things. I don't want to just wash away Genesis 1 through 11 as sheer allegory with no connection to anything that we might regard as real. One thing that got me thinking about how to approach this problem of a retroactive effects of the fall is a paradox in physics called Newcomb's paradox or Newcomb's problem. And the idea is this. You're dealing with an agent that has perfect foreknowledge. And you've got two boxes in front of you. You've got a white box and a black box. The white box will have or not have $1 million in it. The black box will always have $1,000 in it. Okay. Now, this omniscient agent comes to you and says, I will right now either put $1 million or not put $1 million in the white box. And whether I put $1 million in that white box is conditional on whether you tomorrow decide to choose both boxes or just the white box. So you can, tomorrow you've got a choice. You can choose both boxes or you can choose just the white box. And you will take whatever money is in the boxes you choose. If you decide to get greedy and take both boxes, I will have withheld $1 million. But if you choose just the white box, I will have put in $1 million. Okay, so I tell you this, or this omniscient agent tells you this, and then tomorrow rolls around. Now, you can approach this in two ways. You can say, well, you know, the boxes are there. The money is already there. No changes are being made to the contents of that box. You know, yeah, I can take that white box, but hey, that's free money there in that black box, so I'm going to take both. Okay, you do it, and you find, oh, there's no $1 million there. I just get the $1,000. Now, the other thing is you can say, well, I'm going to take just the white box. Okay, now, what do you do? You know, one approach is to say, well, this agent has perfect foreknowledge. I'm going to trust that. This agent acted in anticipation of what I would do, and therefore put the money in if indeed I didn't get greedy and just chose the white box. Now, a lot of the debate, I mean, there's a huge literature which emerged about this problem, and there were one boxers and two boxers, and they pretty much divided evenly in terms of the numbers. You know, should you take both boxes or should you just take one box? And a lot of the debate centered on, well, the nature of an agent that could do this. Now, if we do have a God with perfect foreknowledge, you know, where omniscience includes knowledge of the future, that's much controverted these days among open theists and process theists. But if there is an agent like that, and it seems to me that scriptures teach that our God is such an agent, then God can anticipate our actions. Okay, and so that got me thinking along these lines. And another issue that came up, though, was the nature of divine creation. How does God create? I was involved in a talk on information theory, but one of the key people in that is Claude Shannon. If you look at his book on his theory of communication, came out in the 1940s, he's got a schematic diagram for a general communication system. And I probably should have put a PowerPoint together, but it's usually you see these diagrams, they'll say, sender, message, receiver. Okay, but he elaborates on that a little bit. On the sender side, there's the source, the message, and the transmitter. Then there is a signal that is sent. There's a noise source, signal received. And then there's on the receiver side, there's the actual receiver, a message, and a destination. I looked at that and I thought, isn't it amazing? You've got an actual trinity there on the sender side, because you've got the source, you've got the message, second person of the trinity, the logos, and you've got the transmitter. You know, I mean, how's the transmitter, how does that correspond to the Holy Spirit if we're going to follow this? And I'm running through this very quickly, but I actually elaborate on that a bit. But, you know, when we speak, there's a thought. It has to be articulated. And then it has to be empowered with our breath. Okay? And so it seems that there's something deep going on there. So there's, but this is on the, as it were, heavenly side, on the spiritual side. It's got to be then transmitted to creation. It has to go through a noise source, you know, which might think that that's, there's some sort of evil perhaps connected with that. Perhaps that's where we're dealing with the problems of the fall. But then it has to somehow come into this embodied existence. So what that suggests, though, is that any act of creation is going to have, as it were, two sides to it. You're going to have, it's going to be the conception, the conceptual side in the heavenlies, as it were, but then you're going to have the physical instantiation of it. Okay? And so, let me summarize where I'm going with that. And I will go to that great theologian, Stephen Covey, in his Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. All things are created twice. There's a mental, or first creation, and a physical, or second creation to all things. Okay, and I think we have that experience. So, where am I going with this? Well, I think the challenge, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, there are retroactive effects of the fall, but then we have to still flesh that out, I think, in light of theology and then also exegetical concerns with Scripture. And specifically, how do we make sense of that with Genesis, the first chapters? And it seemed to me that actually this retroactive approach allowed me to make sense of some things which were puzzling, I think, within a lot of traditional approaches to interpreting Genesis. So, for instance, I mean, one of the things one hears, I mean, I've been through a seminary education, many of you probably have, there are these two creation accounts. There's Genesis 1, and then there's Genesis 2 and 3. And usually it's presented as though these come from disparate sources and they're just a kludge. You know, there were these competing or complementary creation accounts out there, and they were just stuck together. But it seemed to me that if we treat the Genesis 1 as creation on the, as it were, sender side, you know, as the divine conception, you know, and I just one distinction I make in the book is causality in an intentional semantic sense, which seems to me fundamental. You know, divine action, divine causation is the fundamental mode of causation. There was a time when, I don't know if we want to say there's a time, but the world is not eternal. You know, God is fundamental, is the fundamental reality, not the world. So in this, this mode of cause, God's purposes, God's intentions, and the meanings, the significance God assigns to that, it seems is the fundamental mode of causation. A causal temporal mode of causation is something that's derived. Okay? And so it seems to me that what we are dealing with in Genesis is when God talks about the creation being good and very good in Genesis 1, it is creation from the vantage of, as it were, the divine causality, the divine order of creation, the logic of creation from God's perspective. Now, it seems to me that that is something we need to take seriously. I mean, if God is creating, designing the world, and I think whether you want to be big idea or little idea, I mean, there's still, we have to say as Christians that God's purposes are being accomplished in creation, that there is an initial or original intention, and that that was good. But then as it plays out in this causal temporal framework, things go awry. You know, I mean, God speaks to the world, and in the Genesis 1, everything obeys him. In Genesis 2 and 3, not everything is obeying him. So what's going on there? And so it seemed to me that what was going on in these two creation accounts is that you had, one is dealing at this temporal causal level, another is working at this intentional, more fundamental level of the creative of God's creation. So it seemed to me that there was this approach makes sense of how these two stories can cohere in a way where they really do fit, where it's not just a kludge. How do you make sense of the 6 days of creation? Well, it seems that these are then fundamental divisions in the divine creative activity. One common objection raised by young earth creationists is how do you make sense of the Decalogue, as given in Exodus, of the 6 days of creation, and then the justification of the Sabbath observance? Well, it seems that if these are fundamental divisions in the divine creative activity, there's not the arbitrariness that there would be if it was that this is the days of creation are actual temporal days, because presumably God could have created in any number of days, or as Augustine suggests, God could have created just instantaneously. So it seemed that there was another thing that this approach was handling, and I'm shortly going to be going over, although I did start a little late. The question of sin and Adam and Eve, I think one thing that this theodicy does commit me to, maybe you'll try to work around it, is a certain anthropocentrism, that humans are the most important entity in creation, that what we do, our sin in particular, our fall, has this trans-historical impact. But the question then also that arises for this theodicy is how to make sense of the fall in space and time. It has effects in space and time, but how can that happen? And one of the things I consider is, in various theological traditions, I mean, there's a sense of paradise and a fall is widely out there. The Islamic tradition, for instance, has, in their view, paradise. The original Garden of Eden was in heaven, and then there was this fall. So it's an interesting twist. But from my vantage, I think, in the Christian perspective, it seems that we want to place the fall within a space-time context. But what's crucial there for the fall is not that the world be, as it were, perfect in a space-time sense everywhere, but it's rather that the original humans need to be, as it were, tempted without natural evil providing undue pressure on them. Okay, it's one thing, I mean, we hear about people who are put in very congested and stressful circumstances and they do evil things. You know? But clearly, it would not be an adequate test for Adam and Eve. They would need to be in a situation in which they would not be unduly stressed. And so what do we have? We've got a garden. You know, now you ask yourself, what need is there for a garden in a world that is perfect, you know, all over the place? You know, why this segregated area? And it seems that this theodicy makes sense of that as well, that we have this segregated area, the test is performed there, but then there's an outside world which is not the garden. And so that itself suggests that there is that natural evil is already present. Okay, so I'm sorry, you know, I'm giving the barest overview. The book will be out. It was originally scheduled, if you go on Amazon, November 1st, but it should be out actually in September. They're rushing this into publication. If you're in the UK, Paternoster is going to be publishing it. It's Brodmann and Holman here, but in some ways I feel in dealing with these questions a bit like a fish out of water, because it's not the usual stuff I do. I mean, what really brought me to it was trying to make sense of the fall in a way that was faithful to the Christian tradition, because it seemed that, I mean, if you read a lot of the contemporary works, it seems that the fall dissolves. In fact, Kyle Guyberson in his latest book, Saving Darwin, has a chapter in which it's entitled "Dissolving the Fall." Okay, so if you think that the fall is worth preserving, and if it's worth understanding natural evil in terms of the fall, which is the very traditional view, then it seems, and if you're not going to be a young earth creationist, it seems you're going to have to go something in the direction that I'm outlining here. So if you are interested in looking more deeply into this, the book is coming out, but I've got some introductory chapters on my website, designinference.com. You can go there, and there are also a bunch of endorsements of the book. So I've got, we're one or two questions. I started late. Yep.
Where would Adam and Eve have come from, and what would have been their history?
Yeah.
How would they have been preserved from environmental influence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good question. I think there are two approaches. I mean, and this is why I said there's nothing that hangs on intelligent design or nothing that really is going against even a theistic evolution position in the book. I think you can take a special creation approach, so be an old earth creationist, where Adam and Eve are created in the garden. Okay, and so they're in this environment which does not predispose them to doing evil acts. And so that would be one option. So then they appear suddenly. The other option would be an evolutionary one in which their consciousness at some point changes, where they become God conscious, where they become rational moral agents made in the image of God. I think that is going to be necessary for this theodicy to work. I think if you want an emergentist where it's just, there's basically all our faculties have counterparts in lower organisms, primates, that's not going to work. And so that's where I would differ with Carl Giberson. Now, he disparages this view. Actually, it's, I think, quite common in Catholic circles where Catholic theologians will accept an evolutionary view, but then there's an infusion of the soul, they'll say. So there's got to come a point of consciousness, and where that consciousness is not merely some sort of elaboration of animal faculties, So, I mean, this is something I will stress, that there has to be a fundamental difference in kind, and not just a difference in degree, And this is so. This will actually take you against a lot of contemporary evolutionary thinking. But yeah, it's a good question. Yep.
Would your view then be incompatible with open deism?
Well, I think it becomes a problem because natural evil, God is anticipating, and in fact uses. I mean, in a sense, I make the claim that God makes the creation defective on purpose. Well, why would he do that? Why would a loving God do that? Well, in a sense, the natural evil, the physical evil, mirrors the wickedness in our hearts. I mean, I make the argument that it's like, when you've got there's this fire raging in our hearts, firefighters will often use fires to stop worse fires from getting out of control. So the natural evil, would we appreciate the full extent of wickedness and rebellion against God if we didn't have things like vipers, like rabies viruses, like all these things? I'd say, do we need as much evil as that? Well, the world could certainly be worse than it is. But we can also imagine it being more halcyon. Has God achieved a proper balance of evil to reflect, mirror the evil in our hearts? This is an argument I make. I think there are perspectives in which this would not sit well. Could you wed an open theistic? Bill Hasker gives me a nice endorsement, although he says I'm a bit harsh on open theism, and I am in the book. I suppose it's possible to take an open theist approach, provided that God at least knows enough to anticipate. What you need is anticipation. Do you need perfect anticipation? I think that would be an interesting question. How much anticipation do you need for this theodicy to work? My sense is that an open theist probably could make peace with this, although some of my rhetoric there is pretty strong against them. I take on Rabbi Kushner, because his views are very similar there, and then Anthony Campolo and others. But the thing, a lot of what drives open theism is the theodicy problem. And if you can get the theodicy while maintaining perfect foreknowledge, it seems that that's, why not do it? Yep.
Some have suggested the retroactive effects of prayer. Mm-hmm. I hear today that some have been an accident. yesterday, I prayed today, things they don't come
from. Yeah, I address that. I mean, C.S. Lewis does, and there's been more recent work on that. Because, in fact, I preface my discussion of Newcomb's paradox with precisely that. Yeah. Yep.
Were you at all influenced by any of
Tolkien?
So, I know that he and Lewis talked about the retroactive effects of prayer. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
He describes this thing where God is singing with the angels, and that is what creation is. Then it has to come into form with the second creation. Then it's progressive.
One thing I found is, I didn't want to just be doing some sort of artificial, we're going to take all these disparate. It seemed that there were a lot of resonances. I don't know Tolkien's work, but it's interesting. Also, just the whole this. Trinitarian view of creation, where it has to pass this barrier of noise. But we have in information theory error-correcting codes which prevent, noise from introducing distortion, preventing the message from accomplishing its end. And we require that with all our email messages. There's noise on the, but we use error correction. So it's a lot of things just seem to fit with this. Now, is it too neat, too pat? Well, we'll see.
I think I see some kind of concepts with you too, to taking the first few lines of scripture. In the first line, God is creating. I kind of think of that mental conceptualization you're talking about. And then the third verse where it's said, spoken into physical existence, is that instantiation.
Mm.
And then the second line talking about the wind and power to do that.
Yeah.
Is the idea to form.
Yeah. Good. One last one. Yeah. Well, actually, I addressed that very point. I won't spend the time reading it. But I think there are two things that are going on. It's one thing to talk about. I was going to cite Dennis Alexander because I engage his most recent book, Creation or Evolution? Do We Have to Choose? And he raises the question of cruelty without humans and says, well, is it really cruel? Because when a tiger munches on some other animal, it's not that the tiger means to be mean, right? It's just doing what a tiger does. But it seems to me still that, it's one thing when we start contemplating it as rational moral agents that there is cruelty, that we react to it that way. And our reaction, it seems to me, is significant. That it's the other side in this debate that always has to rationalize why the evil isn't as evil as we might think it is. So it seems to me that, this has been an issue with the old Earth creationists, because I don't think old Earth creationists have been successful in redressing this problem of natural evil thus far. Because usually they'll say something, well, Romans 5:12 is really talking about human death, it's not talking about animal death, or they're just trying to minimize it, Mark Wharton has a recent book in which he says, well, these God's perfect purposes need to be accomplished, it's not a perfect creation, perfect. But it seems that this natural evil can be very nasty, and it's not just this is, I look at something. There's the question of parasites. The lady who asked about this is no longer here, but you've got the emerald cockroach wasp. A particular wasp really got Darwin upset. It was the Ichneumonidae, which stings a caterpillar, lays its eggs, the caterpillar eats away, saves the vital organs to last, eats it, and then pops out like aliens in the movie, and it says, wow, this is terrible, but you've got even worse stuff than that. You got an emerald cockroach wasp that does a puts one incision in, or one needle in the brain and turns it into a zombie, and then gets on it as a, you know, rides it around, moving its antenna, rides it into its lair, and then sticks another needle in the brain, turns it into a vegetable, you know, and then does the same thing. You know, you've got the, I mean, you've got things that are the nastiness that we see in nature. I mean, it goes beyond, I mean, there's an ingenuity to it. You know, I think this is what something that really turns people away from intelligent design, that, you know, I mean, Francisco Ayala will talk about taking a design perspective as being blasphemous. He uses the word blasphemy precisely because nature seems to give us these things. Well, without a doctrine of the fall and without something, you know, being able to ascribe that nastiness to the fall, I think, you know, we've got problems. Yep.
Bill, I don't know if you're interested in the book or not, but it always strikes me that in the description of the state of nature, the description is good and very good, chosen from the Hebrew words, but their Hebrew words would be translated perfect, and they're not used. So is it possible to infer that for God's own reasons, it was not perfect. It was just good and very good, and it served his purposes with regard to humanity eventually. Yeah.
Well, I mean that's a common line that is taken. You know, I think David Snoke. Well, I have a chapter on old Earth creationism, but while, you know, I think it's one thing to be talking about perfection. It's another thing to be talking about a rabies virus that seems designed to implode a mammalian nervous system. I mean, you've got list after list of really nasty things that are going on in the animal world, and maybe some people can get their minds around it and say, well, you know, that's still good because God's getting his purposes done. I mean, David Snoke, who's talking right now, and he's got address him. He's got a thing, Nitric, Nature in the Rough is Cruel, or something like that. Yeah. But it's still good, you know, as far as he's concerned. Well, if your sensibilities don't allow you to call that good, leave perfection aside, then I think you've got a work of theodicy.
How do you push to get it to
impose our sensibilities? Well, aren't you doing the same thing? I mean, well, it is good. It's good enough. I mean, but I don't see. I mean, you know, I cite the Catholic Encyclopedia. I mean, the idea that physical evil. I mean, it's an old notion. It's not just something that's come up post Darwin. You know, I mean, it's been there. You know, how do you account for it? And the traditional conception has been, it's humans invited it into the world. Because they fell, they rebelled against God, and so if you want to make an argument that hey, don't need that, you know, God creates a world with rabies viruses and things like that. Well, you know, and I think you can. I mean, this is I address also C.S. Lewis's approach, which is to ascribe the fall of the natural evil to rebellion against God, to personal evil. See, the big approach is to try to, I mean, mainstream academic theology basically looks to the autonomy of the world. The world needs and its freedom to produce all these things. So they try to get God out of it that way. But, you know, that seems raises its own questions. But Lewis for him, it's that Satan is responsible for the natural evil. And given how nasty some of the things in nature are, I'm okay with that. But the thing is, Satan wasn't given dominion of the world. Humans were. So unless you can still get, you know, God, it seems, let Satan operate by permission. You know, so why does God permit Satan to do all these things? You know, well, I would say you'd still have to, if you're going to have a coherent theodicy, it's going to be because humans are complicit with Satan, because they fell. Yeah. So I want to trace all. What's central in this theodicy is tracing the natural evil, especially the natural evil that predates humans, still to the fall.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your theological
I'm not sure about that. I mean, it's I think in Hebrews you see things to the effect that it's still all these Old Testament sacrifices were looking toward the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, and it's still with a God who's unbound by time. And I never say in the book, by the way, that God is timeless. It's just that it seems that he's unbound. So it seems then that God still looks at Abraham, for instance, and his faith with the cross there. You know? Now, you might, I think there's, you know, I remember one, you know, when we talk about salvation, I was saved, you know, I was saved at the foundation of the world. If anybody who says, I'm saved, you know, but there's a sense in which I'm being saved and then a sense in which I will be saved. You know, so there are these temporal dimensions to it, but it also talks about Christ being crucified or being slain from the foundation of the world. I still see that the retroactive effects of salvation operate. Okay, but whether they do or not, I mean, I'm taking this as an analogy. It seems that the argument still has to be taken on its own terms about the retroactive effects of the fall and how that might work.
Sounds like you assume our timeline and God's timeline are identical.
Well, actually, I'm saying that time for, I mean, this is a big argument in the book also, distinguish. See, we've got one word for time, but the Greek had two, you know, kairos and chronos. Chronos is this linear notion of time. Kairos is time from the vantage of purposes, and then with God, divine purposes. And it seems that the, as it were, this intentional semantic logic operates in kairos. That's the fundamental logic of creation. And then it plays out in this causal temporal logic, you know, and that, but that there's an interplay there. And so that's something I address also. Yep.
No, I would agree that Lewis's formal development of this is along the lines of as you suggested. But I think he may also have sensed, he'd been maybe attracted to an alternative approach. Because on the epigram to his book, The Problem of Pain, George MacDonald says, "The Son of God suffered unto death, not that men might not suffer, but that their suffering might be like his." He said it's a very different approach to these problems that Lewis is kind of hinting at through MacDonald there, an incarnational approach of a different kind.
I'm fine with that. I think, you know, my opening chapter is on the cross in this book. So it's, I think as I say there, it seems that the only currency of love is in a fallen world is suffering. You know, that's what proves that love is real.
I'll take further the idea, it was in my mind at least, yeah, referring to that. I do think that Lewis was sensing there a kenotic view, a view of divine kenosis. And then, of course, that doesn't get applied to nature until recently, the last 25, 30, 50 years maybe, a kenotic creation, kenotic character of creation. But Lutheran theologians in the 17th century are using that idea, the idea of, for the theology of the crucifixion, the self-emptying emphasis. So in their soteriology, they're using that idea. And then I think it gets transferred, the idea of kenosis, they specifically refer to that. And it's in the mid to late 20th century that it gets applied to creation. So taking an incarnational view of creation from an earlier existing pre-Darwinian, pre-modern science, kenotic approach is perhaps an alternative that Lewis may have been intuitively attracted to by quoting that.
Okay. But do you see an inconsistency, though?
I mean, I'm suggesting there's an alternative. Yeah. That maybe Lewis was also interested in.
Okay. Could be. Bob?
Do you find Polkinghorne's idea of natural good and natural evil being a package deal at all helpful?
Well, no. I mean, I critique it. I think it's if you want to preserve God's goodness in the face of natural or physical evil, it seems that you have two approaches. One is to ascribe the evil to rebellion of a creature, you know, be it humans or Satan or something. You know, but humans, that's certainly been the traditional view. The other is to look to the autonomy of the world, that God has given the world a certain freedom, and then it has to express itself, and it's only in expressing itself that that good can come out, but the thing is there's some necessary evil that comes along for the ride. But it seems to me that raises questions because it seems that the autonomy of the world, Polkinghorne is enough of a Christian that he can't just render the world completely autonomous. So there's still God is doing things. I think he's got even a pretty traditional understanding of creation as God being the source of being. He doesn't have a process view. And so once you have that, God does have responsibility. And then in setting up the creation, well, why didn't he anticipate some of the things that are happening? Does there need to be as much evil as there is? He used to cite the Lisbon earthquake as the big example of natural evil. We'd probably go with the Asian tsunami now, but do we need evil of that extent? So it seems that if you're going to... autonomy is going to be tough to argue, because you've still, if you're doing this within any sort of traditional Christian framework, because you still have a God a God of particular providence who's doing things, who's not just hands off. If you've got a deistic conception of God, then it seems that that approach might work. But I don't think it's successful. It's not clear to me that free will commits God to autonomy. And the whole question of free will. Big portions of the Christian world are theological determinists. Question of free will. How is it that God? If you take it seriously, I do. Why should a free creature created by a good God use or abuse its freedom in certain ways? Given that I hold to perfect divine foreknowledge, I'd have to say God did anticipate, that God did know. But the traditional theodicy there has been, Augustinian, is to say that the good that God could bring out of a world with evil was greater than a world in which was never created or which never had that possibility of evil. But I don't see how that really contradicts this retroactive view.
I think, though, that it's a parallel argument to saying, in effect, that nature has free will, that it has sort of this autonomy, and that God, gave it a certain amount of freedom, and that this, that more good came out of it, but that evil just kind of came along through. I think there's a parallel argument to be made, so, if you're not going to buy that.
Well, but it seems to me that they're different forms of freedom. Free will, we're talking about conscious choices made by intelligent agents. Are you suggesting a Gaia hypothesis where there is some sort of... No, you're not. What we have in nature, the thing is there's a downright perversity that seems to be involved in natural evil. I don't really see the parallel.
Are there graduations? Soulless being made in God's image to elect to spend eternity in hell as opposed to eternal bliss with Him. And I don't understand why we can't sort of set aside all these problems of the relative evil of a caterpillar tough life compared to a human opportunity on stage, however it is portrayed, to find God or not. That's what it's all about, isn't it? It's just the same for each one of us.
Well, it seems that it seems that Eve's sin. Well, but I think where I would go further is say that the backdrop, the tough backdrop, is there precisely to help us recover our sanity. An argument I put forward. John Hick has a view of this world as soul making, that somehow we're in a school, but it seems that this is a pretty harsh school. grinds many of us to powder. And so my preferred image is that of an insane asylum. And it seems that that God is using natural evil to bring us to sanity. It's part of our therapy, as it were. Okay, so it's not arbitrary, you know, but it's not accidental either. It's not just and the natural evil is something that we invited through our sin. It's not something that is just imposed. And if we are indeed the crown of creation, why should transhistorical consequences of the fall be problematic? Especially a God who, Isaiah 65:24, you'll call, you'll ask, and I'll answer before you ask, right? It's that God's answers to prayer, he's already set the answer in motion before we even ask. I think this theodicy will not speak to young earth creationists. And I say in the book, I'd be a young earth creationist in a heartbeat if I thought that the science supported it, but it doesn't, in my view. I don't think it'll speak to more muscular old earth creationists who think that, no problem. God breaks a few eggs, if natural evil is around. And I think it's not going to appeal to the hardcore theistic evolutionists where the evolution is a stricter Darwinian form of evolution in which humans are continuous with primates, where our sensibilities, our cognitive faculties, our moral sensibilities are all continuous. But I think for many evangelicals who are trying to sort through these issues and want a fall that really has some theological punch and also helps to make sense of some of these questions in the science theology discussion, I think it'll go a long way. And I've got lots of nice endorsements for the book, so you can go online and see them.
Hollis mentioned that as a former young creationist who still ensconces very much in the young creationist environment, worship and fellowship, I think actually this is a very, very palatable. I think this is this actually solves a major problem because, as I think you've sort of intimated, that one of the key objections to the young creationist is really about the character of God. And it has to do with God. It has to do with loving God who's omnipotent, who could have chosen to create any universe he wanted. That such a God would create a universe in which instead of something that's built in the fabric of organic life. As soon as you brought this up, and I never thought about this before, and also, of course, we absolutely believe that the Lamb of God was slain from the foundation of the world. So there's already this concept, what you quoted from Isaiah, the concept is already there embedded in our system of my theology. I actually think this. Tim Keller's now working with BioLogos to develop courses. That's, I think, a really positive step forward as well because he's a respected pastor. So I view this very positively, and I think this, when this sort of input, and I think that you've done a really good job in this of really, first of all, discerning and intuiting what, first of all, what the biblical demands we consider and take seriously, at least from a point of consideration, and also looks at what young creationists and others. Progressive creationists also what they're going to need, and I think you begin to sort of reconcile things in a really thoughtful way that involves the pastoral. And so I just want to commend you to that. I think this is a really valuable place. I'm going to do everything I can to buy an advanced copy of this book because I want to have some of my pastors read it the week of my return.
All right. Well, this is good. It was one last. I guess we've gone over way over, so it's.
Bill, I'm sorry I didn't get into the beginning of your talk, but what Ted was saying earlier about the Book of Job being a text in the Bible, and I'm inclined to agree with that. And of course, at the end of the story, some questions are left unanswered, and around theodicy.
questions about the other theory are kind of open at the end about why is this law kind of suffering occurring. And it is not directly related to morality or the sin of Job or something. So I'm thinking that, you know, Calvin talks about this idea of the noetic effects of sin.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that maybe, you know, all of us, we're all fallen creatures, right? As of now, you and I are all fallen. And part of that may be that we can't understand some of these things because we're in the midst of it. We ourselves can't comprehend it because we are fallen. We're not angels. We're not God. So there's some blocks that help us, that prevent us from coming up with a nice, neat answer to everything. This is, and I think there's a sense of mystery that's still there. And so creationists come up with, you know, what is this saying? One fool can answer more questions than a wise man can ask, you know. That's the kind of thing that we're dealing with here, I think. And sometimes I think my sense is that we have to sometimes just step back, like St. Elizabeth, and just cry at the suffering.
Yeah, but I would make a distinction, though, between, you know, in these Romans 8:28, God works all things to the good of those who love him, right? And we don't see that in this life. I grant you that. You know, I mean, you know, we sometimes may try to rationalize why some event of seeming, you know, purposeless, random suffering really has a reason. You know, but that, often though, that's unsatisfying. But I think, you know, those are with specific questions, specific things that happen in this life. But I think the general problem, though, of, you know, the sin in the world, the evil in the world, the natural evil in the world, what's responsible for it? You know, what does it trace back to? It seems to me that that is a theological question which we do need to answer. You know, and I think the tradition has been very clear on it, that we invited the evil when we rebelled against God. Okay, so I'm 100% committed to that answer. Does not mean that when I deal, you know, got a son who's dealing with autism, you know, it's torn me apart. Okay, but how do I explain that? You know, I'm still going to keep working, try to bring him back. Okay, you know, but I don't have a good explanation. You know, but that's what I deal with. But the general problem, though, of evil, it seems to me, does have an answer.
Bill?
Yeah.
It strikes me that if you have the view that God created something perfect, the creator of God, the universe, he did that big thing, and then man comes along and he screws up his whole creation just by a little volitional act, that makes man big as God. That seems really weird to me.
That's a weird comment.
I'm not sure. I mean, one of the things I consider, I mean, there's G.K. Chesterton talks about, let's see if I can find this, because it's, I think it answers your concern very well. Just hang on a second. Hope I can find it. Give me a moment. No, it's executive summaries are usually one page. This is one paragraph, so you're in good shape. It is the prime philosophic principle of Christianity that this divorce, he's talking about creation always involves a divorce, that the creator and the creation, so it's not that the creation is an extension or a prosthesis or something, that this divorce, which is always involved in creation, in the divine act of making, such as severs the poet from the poem or the mother from the newborn child, was the true description of the act whereby the absolute energy made the world. According to most philosophers, God, in making the world, enslaved it. According to Christianity, in making it, he set it free. God had written not so much a poem, but rather a play. A play he had planned as perfect, but which had necessarily been left to human actors and stage managers who had since made a great mess of it. Okay? Well, I think the point is God had made the play, we messed it up, and now he's got to rewrite the play. You know, now that doesn't make us more important than God, but it means that we have our sin, God has to deal with it. You know, I don't know why you're shaking your head. I mean, God has dealt with it at the cross. You accept that. That doesn't make, I mean, the cross doesn't make us more important than God, but it does show that God is deeply concerned that we are the creatures of his love, and he's going to go all out to try to restore us, and not just us, but a prodigal universe back to himself. But, okay. All right, thanks. All right, so you had some questions.